As the Iowa caucus creeps up on the Democratic candidates, it can be hard to keep track of who says what. But what if it all boils down to one question for voters? What did you think of Clinton? Or maybe to put it more exactly, what did you think of Clintonism? I'm Veronica Rickard, and today for Kathleen Dunn here on the Ideas Network. In some spheres, Clintonism is a dirty word, synonymous with spineless compromise and a kind of wishy-washy middle ground. In others, among Clinton advocates, Clintonism is evocative of a new kind of politics, kind of invented by Bill Clinton, a vision for a new democratic leadership in a changing economy, focusing on the struggling middle class. This hour, well, there's something about Bill. So what did you think about Clintonism? Do you differentiate between the politics and the man? And how do your feelings about Bill Clinton influence your feelings about Hillary? Call us with your thoughts today at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Our guest this hour covers national politics for the New York Times Magazine and is the author of the book, The Argument: Billionaires, Bloggers, and the Battle to Remake Democratic Politics. Matt Bai, thanks so much for joining us this hour.
Hey, Veronica, glad to do it. How are things out there?
Snowy.
I'm so surprised.
Yeah, it's a quintessential Wisconsin winter day. We've been getting hammered with snow.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, that's life in Wisconsin. I guess you'll be shocked to know it's going to be about 50 degrees in Washington today.
I'm jealous. We'll talk no more about that. So let's talk about your article. It's called The Clinton Referendum. And when we talk about Clinton, he's always been a polarizing figure. But when we talk about Bill Clinton and Clintonism, as your article is more about, are we talking about the man or are we talking about his politics?
Well, we're talking a little bit about both, although when I talk about Clintonism, I'm really talking about the political philosophy. The way I describe it in the piece is that, you know, if you ask Democrats how they feel about Bill Clinton personally, it is overwhelmingly popular. You'd probably, in any given day, get an approval rating of almost 90%, and there is a tremendous, wealth of gratitude and appreciation for him personally. And then if you ask Democrats how they feel about centrism or triangulation or the Democratic Leadership Council or, you know, Clintonism as a philosophy, it's considerably less appreciative. And people really feel that the party, the national party, went in the wrong ideological direction in the 1990s. But they don't blame Clinton personally for this. And so it's not as if there's a camp of people who love Clinton and a camp of people who hate him. I think the real story here, and the thing that makes this so difficult to write about and understand, is that for a lot of ordinary Democrats, there's a conflict. There is a deep down, a really conflicted feeling about what those years meant, because you have this personality, this person that people really admire, politically, and a person whose presidency they would gladly have back, and you have a political philosophy that people harbor some real resentment for.
Well, it's kind of interesting that there is that dichotomy between the man and what happened to the Democratic Party during his leadership. How do you think those two got sort of divided? Usually aren't people sort of synonymous with what they accomplish?
Yes, it's highly unusual, and it makes it very difficult to sort of grasp where people are on Hillary's candidacy. And I think it got divided largely because of the impeachment and the way that Clinton was attacked by the right. And a lot of Democrats who hated that period and hated what Republicans did to him, in their view, did not want to blame him. You know, they wanted to rally around him. They also admired the fact that he won, because winning in the Democratic Party on the presidential level had become very rare, obviously. He's only the third Democrat of the 20th century. There were only three.
Right, someone in your article said it was like being a Red Sox fan. You never won.
Right. There were only three who won two terms. Right.
Right.
Susan Estrich, who says, you know, it was like being a Red Sox fan. Even, you know, she said you never won, and when you won, you lost because you got Jimmy Carter. So she said, you know, she said Clinton, you know, led us out of the desert, and so, you know, in the post-Reagan years. And so so there is this wanting to rally around him, and so I think what a lot of Democrats have done is displaced their frustration over the politics, is to find other people to blame for Clintonism, when in fact you really have to look at him. I mean, the Democratic Leadership Council, which is so demonized online, which was his, you know, his think tank that he was the chairman of when he was elected president, Joe Lieberman, and, you know, who takes a huge hit for sort of representing centrism. You know, there are there are sort of a bunch of targets here, the Washington establishment. When Howard Dean ran for president in 2004, he never ran against Clinton personally, but he had a whole bunch of other sort of Washington culprits. But the emotion that he was running on, his argument, was absolutely the dismantling of the Clintonian political philosophy, was absolutely to argue that the philosophy of the 90s had led the party in the wrong direction. And I think the Dean campaign, more than anything else, sort of is a crucible here for this dichotomy between not blaming the man, but, you know, really despising the philosophy.
Well, you get the sense, you know, when you write about the blogosphere, that Clinton is referred in those political blogs as the big dog, which sort of seems to connote a kind of cool respect, almost like a cult figure.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, on the other hand, you know, what people were saying around the time of Howard Dean's ascendancy was that Clintonism might have been for nothing. What did we get for it?
Right. I think that's a very fair assessment of it. It's a lot of people spent the 90s, a lot of Democrats, I think, spent the 90s thinking that there was a payoff at the end. They didn't like welfare reform. They didn't like free trade. They didn't like the changes on the social issues, the sort of compromises. And they said, well, Bill Clinton is showing us the way. And if we can continue to win, then we can build a really progressive government and majorities, and we can achieve the things we all know we really want to achieve. And, of course, there were two problems with that. One is that I think it misread what Clinton was trying to do. He was not trying to hide his liberal intentions just long enough to gain power. He actually had a very different view for where he thought the Democratic Party should go philosophically, and that's the thing that people always forget. They don't want to attribute that to him. They want to say, well, he was just kind of it was all tactical, and I don't think that's the case. And the other problem, of course, is that it didn't work out that way. You had the election of 2000, you had the midterms of 2002, you had the vote on the war, and a lot of very angry Democrats who felt that they had sort of quietly bit their lips and seethed throughout the 1990s, waiting for a moment that not only never came, but actually, the result was much worse.
Well, you know, all of this that we're talking about, it sort of puts Hillary Clinton's campaign in a bit of a sticky wicket, because however they choose to use Bill Clinton, it sounds like they're not sure what they're going to get. What is he going to bring up in voters? Is he going to stir up the mud puddle and bring up unpleasant associations about the Democratic Party's direction? Or are they going to activate, you know, kind of pleasure centers of warm fuzzies for Bill Clinton?
They are in a sticky wicket. Yeah, I mean, this has been a difficult thing for them to deal with. And the classic example of this happened several weeks ago where, you know, they want to put Clinton out there because he is so popular and crowds love him and they come out, and when he vouches for her and validates her and talks about her as a wife and a partner and all that she did as a first lady, I think it's very valuable to them. And then, you know, several weeks ago, apropos of nothing and certainly not scripted, he says, you know, in front of all the camera banks and the voters, this Iraq war, which I opposed from the start. And of course, everybody immediately says, "No, you didn't. You said you were for it." I think it was kind of one of those classic Clintonian moments. He didn't need to say it. He wasn't against the vote to authorize the invasion. He had sort of a tortured reasoning around it, and you know, in his mind, he had opposed it, and so he just sort of said it, sort of blurted it out. But what it had the effect of doing was to say, I think, to a lot of voters, here we go again. You know, here's the I didn't inhale. Here's the, you know, I did not have sex with that woman. Here's the, you know, here's the part of Clinton we didn't like, which is, you know, when he just kind of comes out with these things that, you know, aren't true. And so that's the real danger for them. The real danger for Hillary Clinton's campaign is not that people are going to reject Bill Clinton or decide they hate him, because they don't. They love him. The real danger is that he'll remind people of the things they've now put a little further out of their minds about the 90s that they really didn't like. And really, Obama's argument in particular, Edwards too, but particularly Brian, and they're both very much in this race, but particularly Barack Obama's argument, which has been, you don't want to go back there. It was great, and he did some great things, but look, do you really want to go back to that time? Are you really thinking about what it was like? And so I think it particularly played into Obama's argument.
On the other hand, you wonder maybe if there was a way for Hillary's campaign to play their cards right, they could capitalize on, you know, Bill Clinton is a rock star. I mean, he's more than a rock star. He's this incredible figure that you said people really respond to. If they were able to sort of steer it in that direction, do you think that's possible?
Well, they do. And the comparison I make is to someone like Muhammad Ali or Paul McCartney, you know, people who are sort of legends who are still among us. You know, people who are historical figures still walking and breathing, and it's a different, it's different than celebrity. It transcends celebrity. He is a huge force, and when you see him go into a room, even people who didn't vote for him or you know didn't like him, you know, it's a moment. People meet Bill Clinton, they introduce their children to Bill Clinton. It's the kind of thing. It's like folks who met Ronald Reagan or others. It's the kind of thing where you know, this story will be told 50 or 60 years forward. And in a way, it's very different from someone like Reagan or a lot of the other political heroes that we've had, because he's still relatively young and vibrant. And when you meet him, it's like meeting him as president, right? He's still kind of walking around being himself. But and so they are, you know, they are very much trying to get him out there and on the trail and talking to voters. You know, the one thing about it that I think has surprised a lot of us who expected to see this is that Clinton doesn't do the big sort of political stem winder anymore. He really doesn't want to. He likes the dignity of the post-presidency. He doesn't want to compromise it. He doesn't want to be seen as a political hack. He gives a very quiet, substance-laden speech. I think it's very effective to the crowds that he sees, but it's just surprising. It's not the kind of political rallying cry that he was so great at as his own candidate.
And do you think that's his own choice instead of the
choice? I do. I really do. I've talked to a lot of people about it, and I think I do think that is it's by design and it's by his own design. He just doesn't feel that it's that's how his role should be. I mean, I think as much as he wants his wife to win, he sees a certain responsibility and role for an ex-president, and he's really loath to deviate from that.
Would you say that there is a Clinton backlash going on right now among Democrats, or did that sort of peak around the time of Howard Dean last time around?
Well, I think it exists. I do think it probably peaked. It probably peaked with Dean and with the war vote. But I hesitate to call it a Clinton backlash. I think it's a Clintonism backlash. I think there is a genuine distaste for the kind of politics he unleashed on the party, for the politics of centrism. I mean, just looking at where the energy is in the party, I mean, you still have the Democratic Leadership Council. You have a group called Third Way here in Washington, which is pretty vibrant on the Hill. But there's very little self-described center beyond those two groups left in the Democratic Party. Nobody's standing up and saying, we represent the center, you know, which was, you know, Bill Clinton's rallying cry, and many, many people followed him. And that, more than anything else, tells you, you know, how the winds have shifted in the party. And, you know, you don't hear anyone talking about the revival of Clintonism. You hear people talking about the success of Clinton. And he, by the way, gets very frustrated with this, because he has said to many people, and he has said to me, that, you know, people think I'm like Michael Jordan and I had a 4-foot vertical leap. In other words, people think his political skills were so great, that he was so gifted, that that's why he succeeded. And he says, no, it was the ideas. It was the argument we put forth about modernizing government and modernizing the Democratic Party. And if you miss that, you miss the point of my presidency. And I do think people miss that.
Well, you do make the point in your article that Clinton's gains in the White House were kind of strangely ephemeral. They've been sort of rolled back or wiped out, kind of like a footprint in the sand that's been washed away. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people think that's because of his centrist policies. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's right. There are people who think that. I mean, most Democrats would probably tell you, if you ask them, you know, why have the gains of Clinton's years in office, the late 90s, been reversed in so many areas economically, in terms of crime, socially? I mean, we've really had indicators that have really gone backward. And they would say, well, Bush is an incompetent president, also that he's really tried to undo the Clinton legacy, that he really tried to dismantle all the great things Clinton put in place. And I think there's some truth to that. But then there's this whole other strain of thought which says, you know, the reason those gains went away is because they were grounded in a conservative notion of government, is that Bill Clinton tried to out-conservative the Republicans or meet them in the middle, and his economic priorities and his governing priorities were very much in line with the first Bush administration or the Reagan administration, that he only sort of tinkered around the edges, and that those gains were fleeting because they were not built on a solid foundation, and they made it, and his meeting Republicans in the middle made it very possible for a guy like a radical like Bush to come in and say, you know, okay, now we're going to go even further in this direction. Mm-hmm. That he didn't stop the trend of conservatism and therefore contributed to it. He obviously vigorously disagrees with that, and I think it's an unfair, a very uncharitable interpretation, but it's an important strain in Democratic thought to understand.
going back to Hillary Clinton's campaign, do you think that she is running kind of at least perceptually to voters as Bill the sequel? Or do you think that she's embracing that Clinton legacy, or is she wanting to do something new?
Well, I think she's absolutely running as a sequel. I mean, the entire argument, underlying argument of Hillary Clinton's campaign, and I've not seen anything that says otherwise, is, let's go back to where we were before things got completely off the rails. We had a great administration. The country was in great shape. We've had 8 years of craziness and extremism, and let's go back. They say it's not about the past. It's about the future and all the things she wants to do. But the only vision of the campaign is a bunch of policy proposals that pick up where Bill Clinton left off. There's no different interpretation. You could not identify a way in which Hillary Clinton's view of government, view of Democratic Party, view of where the country needs to go at this moment is any different or is it distinct in any way from where Bill Clinton was at when he left office. So it's definitely, they are definitely running to sort of pick up where they left off.
So I guess, as you put it in your article, it really does come down to, what do you think about Clintonism? And do you have a sense of how Democrats are leaning on that question right now?
No, no more than I have a sense of who's going to win the primaries in Congress. I mean, I think it's a conflict for Democrats. I think it's a very personal decision.
You call it almost an existential crisis.
Yeah. For a lot of the Democrats I meet and talk to, and that includes both insiders and people who do this for a living, but an awful lot of ordinary voters, it is a genuine personal conflict about, boy, I love Bill Clinton, I like Hillary Clinton, but I didn't like a lot of that. I don't know that I want to go back to that. I don't know that that's the governing philosophy I want. And how they pull the lever or caucus or whatever it's going to be, I think that's a decision we'll know when it happens.
We're talking this hour with Matt Bai. He covers national politics for the New York Times Magazine and is the author of the book, The Argument, Billionaires, Bloggers, and the Battle to Remake Democratic Politics. Hope you'll call us this hour with your thoughts about the Clinton referendum. Do your thoughts about Bill Clinton and his politics, maybe more specifically, influence how you're looking at the Democratic candidates and, of course, especially Hillary Clinton? Hope you'll call us this hour at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. I'm Veronica Rickard in today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Organic gardening practices and cover crops in the home garden are two of the topics for today's Garden Talk on Larry Mueller after 11 o'clock today. Veronica Rickard back with you here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm in today for Kathleen Dunn. And we're talking with Matt Bai, who covers national politics for the New York Times Magazine, about his article which recently ran called The Clinton Referendum. And Matt Bai, we have some folks waiting to talk to you, so we'll take a call now from Jim in Salt Lake City.
Hi. Hey, thanks for the call. I was just listening to your guest, and one of the things that I always wondered back in the 70s is how people could be so endeared to Richard Nixon. They talk about all the things, but despite his personal habits. And I was a big Clinton supporter. I've heard him speak. And he talked about being a retread Democrat after losing in Arkansas, how he wasn't going to make the same mistake twice, and how he was going to listen to the voters and all this. And I was excited about his wife, Hillary, being a member of NOW and all that. And I was just like, right on, we have our person. And then all the wheels came off. He started accusing all these innocent women and then lied. And then I guess the thing that made me wonder is if we were losing our soul or our whole purpose when even NOW didn't come out and say, hey, what you did was wrong. You abused your power. Despite all the good that you've done, you're not a good person when your relationships with your workers were people who entrusted you. And I would call him the Richard Nixon of the Democratic Party. We kind of forget about his habits and look at a couple of other things, and it kind of disturbs me. And I'm not faulting Hillary for this, and I'm not sure how I feel about her candidacy, but I just think it's a terrible legacy for the Democratic Party that we forget all those things and just remember the good, because he was not a good person to certain people who entrusted him, who worked with him in Arkansas, even in the White House.
All right, thanks for the call, Jim. Matt, bye.
You know, Jim, that's not a terrible comparison. I mean, Clinton would hate it, and there's some things about it that aren't fair, but one thing about it, you know, first of all, it is true, Republicans embraced Nixon because he was able to win even when they didn't love him personally. It's also true, you know, that the right wing or the base of the Republican Party never trusted or liked Nixon in office. He was a pretty liberal president, actually. In fact, some liberals would argue more liberal than Clinton was. And in a similar way that Clinton was very, you know, has so much suspicion from the base of his own party politically. So it's not a bad comparison, you know. But I think Jim really typifies what we're talking about. I mean, I think he's very typical of the way Democratic voters feel. If I could paraphrase what he said, and hopefully accurately, it would be that, you know, he had a lot of hope in the 90s and is proud of what Clinton accomplished and what he's done for the Democratic Party, but really disappointed in a lot of the things that happened in the 90s. They really make him uneasy. They don't make him feel good about politics, and he just doesn't really want to go back to it, you know, have that era back again. And he is, I don't know who Jim's voting for, but that's the, you know, and maybe in Utah, it doesn't matter right now, but he is, you know, he's the target voter for a Barack Obama or a John Edwards, because that is their argument, is, you know, do you really want to be triangulating again? They make the argument slightly differently, but both of them attempt to sort of seize on that exact sentiment.
And Jim didn't say he wouldn't support Hillary Clinton. He just said he wasn't sure at this point. So it sort of
right. Seems
like a waiting game to see how all the pieces settle.
I think that's right. And it's not just a waiting game, but it's a question of, does somebody make an argument convincing enough to pull you away from Hillary Clinton? Is an Obama or an Edwards compelling enough in what they're offering so that you feel comfortable doing that?
Okay, thanks for the call, Jim. And here's one from Flash in Wauwatosa. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Veronica. You have a lovely radio voice, A-plus radio voice.
Thank you.
It's clear as a bell. Okay, Matt, you're shoveling a lot of yellow snow. I'm a Republican for the past 42 years. Please run Hillary Clinton. We'll destroy her with the Republican roto stripper. to compare Bill Clinton to Ronald Reagan in the same sentence, I had to gag. But gag me with a spoon, buddy. Bill Clinton raped Democrat activist Kathleen Wiley, forced penetration in the Oval Office. You give me a break, pal. We have 8 years file thick of dirt on Bill and Hillary the co-president. We'll destroy them in the election.
All right.
Wow, your screeners are having a slow day, huh? Shoving yellow snow. All right.
That's very descriptive. All right, we'll go on to Laverne in Monroe. Hey, Laverne, you're on the air.
Good morning, Veronica. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning.
I voted for Bill Clinton because, like he said, it's the economy, stupid. And if Hillary Clinton taxed those corrupt hedge fund dealers like she said she's going to do, that's what's causing our problems with the economy. I remember when Bill Clinton left office, just those wonderful Republicans said, we had these surpluses as far as the eye can see, and anybody that paid federal income tax, which I did, got $300 back in the mail. So Bill Clinton did what he said he was going to do, and I hope Hillary Clinton does the same thing.
Okay, thanks for the call, Laverne. Matt, bye.
Well, there's the flip side, right? I mean, people who say, you know, look, it was a successful presidency. He did what he was supposed to do. He left office. The nation was in good shape. 7 years later, 8 years later, the nation's in not in good shape. The vast majority of voters think it's going in the wrong direction. Let's just go back to people who know how to run the government. And I think you do. I think, you know, I would say there's a preponderance of support for Hillary Clinton where you get her strongest support, just in talking to voters. This is not scientific, but it is my gut. Where you get the strongest support are in people whose vision of government is really pretty limited to the machinery of how you fix things. That is, you know, is sort of a technocratic view of government. A lot of people, a lot of Democrats have always believed, and will tell you now, it's sort of a strain in Democratic politics that, you know, this isn't about reforming government. This isn't about some grand vision. I don't need somebody to come and tell me that, you know, this new century requires an overhaul of government or whatnot. You know, we need people who have practical, doable solutions to obvious, distinct problems and can sort of run the ship efficiently. And in fact, both parties are sort of running that way this year. And for those voters, I think Hillary Clinton is very appealing because they feel Bill Clinton did a pretty good job at the tiller of government. They think she's ready and experienced and was around and can do the same. You know, it's ironic because Bill Clinton himself was really a grand vision guy and has always been really a guy who saw, you know, who had a sort of new vision for the party and for a new century of government. But there is, you know, there is a strong technocratic impulse toward having people back who ran the government effectively in their view.
How do you think that plays out in the Obama and Edwards campaign?
Well, I mean, they're both arguing for something completely different than that. I mean, there's nothing technocratic about their campaigns. Obama's effectively saying we need a generational shift. We need a whole new way of looking at these problems. We can't go back to the baby boomer fights of the 90s. You know, this has to be a new political approach. And John Edwards is talking about boldness. He's basically saying enough half a loaf, enough meeting in the middle. If you want to get real change, you have to be confrontational, you have to be bold, you have to be divisive. You know, he's really playing to the base of the party who feels Clintonism was about, you know, little tiny steps. So in a sense, you know, it becomes a referendum on what government is really about. Is government about incremental, practical change, or is government about some greater sweeping format? And as I say, that's ironic, because Bill Clinton in 1992 would certainly have fallen into the Edwards-Obama camp than into his wife's.
Going back to the phones now, here's a call from Roger in Appleton. Hi, Roger. You're on the air.
Thank you. I think I view the Clinton years as a period of time when we could be proud as Americans, the world could be proud as the world, because our approval rating internationally was hovering between 80 and 90%. Now it's around 7 to 8. You know, that just didn't happen. Clinton studied the world. He knew the world. He knew how the world interacted together. And like even yesterday with Bhutto getting assassinated, I think George Bush was the last one of the international leaders on the air at least making some sort of a comment about it. That's a disgrace. And I think when I view the Clinton years economically, domestically, internationally, there were very, very positive things that people felt at that time that they don't feel now.
And do you think that Hillary's campaign is able to capitalize on those good
things? Oh, I don't know. That campaign is going to be different. It has to be. The times have changed a bit. But I think that you certainly have a format there that I think could be worked with to make this our next years a better time than the past several.
And maybe that's the carrot, you know, return to the good times. Matt Bye?
Yeah, that is absolutely the care. But you know what Roger's saying is you know makes some sense. If you talk to Democrats in Washington, if you talk to people who you know strategize, they'll tell you one of the things they'll tell you is that the great advantage Bill Clinton has is George W. Bush, that the last 7 years have really made Clinton look so much better by comparison. That whatever public esteem he might have lost through events of the late 90s were sort of forgotten or restored because of what's happened under his successor. And I think, you know, Roger is certainly proving that point.
Thanks a lot for that call. And we'll take one now from Rich in Rhinelander. Welcome, Rich. You're on the air.
Thank you. In this debate over whether Bill Clinton was a visionary or a cynic and what he did to the Democratic Party, I was pretty much a backer during that period of time. But in reflection, I came to think of it as the triumph of the Clinton presidency as the triumph of advertising and focus group phrases, you know, work hard, play by the rules, and all that kind of stuff. And the triumph of advertising over what he said were going to be progressive policies. And as one key element, first of all, I think he did nothing vis-a-vis the changes in Russia to really help set a direction. And you could talk about nuclear summits and what was done, you know, near the end of his presidency or whatever. But I do think that again and again he promised and then he contradicted himself. He was the president of the United States. He said way back near the beginning of his first administration, we're going to change the policy towards gays in the military, And then you had Sam Nunn or someone pop up and say, oh, no, we're not. And some generals pop up and say, oh, no, we're not. And he was so compromised himself in his thinking between cynicism and being a visionary that he simply said again and again, okay, if it comes to a choice between unions and free trade agreements, I'll go with the side that has the more power and the more money. And I lost respect for him, and to a certain degree, I don't truly trust Hillary Clinton to be much different from Bill Clinton in that regard.
Thanks for that call, Rich, and it sounds like you're echoing a lot of the concerns some Democrats have with Clintonism, those that were not so thrilled with it. Matt Bai?
Yeah, I'd like to know. Is Rich still on the phone?
Yeah, I think he is.
I'd like to know who he'd vote for.
Who would you vote for, Rich? Are you comfortable telling us? Oh, I guess we lost him.
I mean, that because to me, that's where, you know, that comment leads is I do think it echoes a lot of the sentiments we've been talking about. And then the question is, who benefits from it? Is it then, you know, do you pivot from what Rich is saying and say, what I think we need is a much bolder, is a bolder sort of call for change, a more activist, liberal, old-style Democratic government, and in which case, you know, John Edwards might be your guy, or do you pivot from that and say, you know, I just want a new way of looking at these problems. I don't want the partisanship and the fighting and the, you know, constant outmaneuvering of one group or another. And do you say, you know, maybe Barack Obama gives us a fresh start? I mean, that, to me, that next question is the one that's, you know, right now going to define what happens in the next, you know, 10, 14 days.
Well, what's interesting, someone makes the point in your article that no matter who wins, if a Democrat does indeed take the Oval Office, no matter who that person is, they're going to be governing from the center because it sounds like they thought there's nowhere else to go.
Well, that's the contention. That's Jonathan Cowan from Third Way, and that is certainly his contention. I mean, I think there's some validity to that. I certainly think, you know, what I think is absolutely true is that if you look at the campaigns of Edwards and Obama, they certainly try to capitalize on you know, Rich's resentment with what Clintonism became, and yet they are in their own ways very Clintonian candidates. You know, Obama, a lot of his rhetoric and his philosophy since he got into national office in 2004 or 2005 when he was seated have been are remarkably reminiscent of the early Clinton, more so, much more so than Hillary Clinton's. And John Edwards' policies, despite all the talk about boldness and the scale of his proposals and the expense of his proposals, the actual policy innovations very much echo, you know, the Clinton's programs of the 90s. There's very little there that either doesn't stem directly from Clintonism or that would have been problematic for the people who ran the Clinton administration. So, you know, Bill Clinton changed his party, changed the DNA of his party in some ways that are so basic that they're almost not recognizable.
Do you think that those candidates acknowledge that legacy, or is it just a tricky line to walk?
I think in another time and place they would acknowledge that legacy. I don't think they're unaware of it,
right?
But it's just not a convenient. It's not convenient to the argument that they're making. So
not a good time to say thank you, Bill.
I don't know if it I don't know if it reaches the level of hypocrisy because in politics we set that bar pretty high.
Mm-hmm.
But it would certainly qualify as irony.
All right, we're talking with Matt Bai this hour. He covers national politics for the New York Times Magazine and is the author of the book, The Argument. We're talking this hour about his article, The Clinton Referendum, which appeared in the New York Times Magazine. Hope you'll join in our conversation this hour and tell us what you think. Do your feelings about Clintonism influence your thoughts about how you're going to decide on candidates, Democratic candidates, in the upcoming race? The number is 1-800-642-1234. Broadcasting from Madison today, so this is a different number. It's 1-800-642-1234. I'm Veronica Rickert, in today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. After 11 o'clock, organic gardening practices and cover crops in the home garden are two of the topics for today's program on Larry Mueller. That's coming up after 11 o'clock. I'm Veronica Rickert, back with you in today for Kathleen Dunn here on the Ideas Network. And we're talking about the article, The Clinton Referendum. It was written by Matt Bai, our guest today. He covers national politics for the New York Times Magazine, and he's author of a book, The Argument. And Matt Bai, let's take a call now from Jake in Menasha. Hi, Jake, go ahead.
Hi, good morning. My question is, I've been a supporter of the Green Party for the past 10 years, and prior to that, I was an independent. My question to the guest is, in my opinion, there used to be a dime's worth of difference between the Republican and Democratic parties, and now there is about a penny's worth of difference. What would your response be to that? And I'll take your answer off the air.
Thanks.
You know, Jake, I got into this whole political mess covering a lot of independent politics. I still find it very interesting. I still think it has great potential in America. And if you'd asked me this question, I think this is a cyclical question. In other words, the answer doesn't, as you point out, isn't always the same. And if you'd asked me this question 8 years ago, I would have probably agreed with you that there was a dime's bit of difference, because in the underlying structure of the political parties and the way that they're funded and the way that they operate and their overall worldview of sort of the moment we're living in, there's sort of disturbingly little difference at times. But I don't think at this moment you can credibly argue that either party in office does the same thing, that the country would be going in the same direction and that not much would change. I think George W. Bush's presidency really drew a line there, and he really departed and went off in a direction. It took his party in a direction that was far further to the extreme. And I think Democrats have responded in some measure, depending on who wins the nomination, by going further, further to the extreme. So I do think there's a difference in how the parties would govern. I do think if you care about the direction of the country, that you are sort of forced to make a choice at this point. But I'm sympathetic to the underlying point, which is that the system itself and this generation of leadership in both parties seem to be mired in the same dysfunction, and I think that's one of the things that makes Barack Obama appealing to a lot of younger people and to a lot of disaffected Democrats, is that he's saying it's not just Republicans, it's both parties, it's the generation, it's the system, and that it needs to change.
Yeah, you're right, Matt, but I think that is an argument you heard a lot. You remember when Ralph Nader was running against Gordon and Bush, and you don't really hear people making that argument too much anymore.
No, and not even Ralph. I mean, it's just a harder argument to make, and I always was very sympathetic to Ralph Nader. I thought it was pretty unfair to blame him for the 2000 election. Everybody who thinks they have something to contribute, if they want to run, they should run, and you got to go out and earn your votes, right? And he didn't earn that many. Most American elections are not decided by, half a percentage point. So I'm, as I say, I'm very sympathetic to the idea that more options are good. But at this moment, I think this is one of those elections, and, they're probably rarer than not, when you really have a pretty stark choice about what direction you want to take the country in.
Okay, thanks for that call, Jake. And here is Sally in Middleton. Hi, Sally.
Good morning.
Morning.
I'm one of the older generations, and I grew up in a Republican household, and I heard plenty about the tax and spend Democrats. And I haven't heard much in this race, even, that when Clinton came in, I believe there to office, there was quite a debt. When he left office, there was no debt. And nobody seems to be mentioning that now certainly we have a debt, but of course people say, well, that's the war. But who got us into this war? Why don't the Democrats hit the fiscal side more?
Well, sir, if you were in Iowa or New Hampshire, you'd have a different view. It gets hit all the time. It may. I think one of the reasons you don't hear so much about it is probably that it's been talked about so much that the media has sort of stopped. There are certain lines and themes that are brought up so much that the media stops repeating them because it's just repetitive. And so, after a while, you feel like you haven't heard it. But, certainly one of the most used Democratic lines about Bush, and certainly one that Hillary Clinton would talk about a lot, is, Clinton left office with these surpluses, and now we have these deficits. I mean, it's pretty much included every time people give a litany of what's transpired under this administration.
I wanted to ask you about your, I don't want to say audiences, that's the wrong word, but your talks you've had with Bill Clinton. You've gotten to meet him personally a couple of times.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a sense of how he sees his role and how comfortable he is with his role, kind of as second fiddle with Hillary Clinton's campaign?
You know, I that's not something, you know, he shared with me. I've talked to a lot of people who know him well and do talk to him about it. And, you know, they say that he's, you know, he's, you know, the surprising thing about it, they say, is that he's, you know, trying to find the time, really, that he actually is very into his foundation work, that he feels very committed to it, and the post-presidency that he's building. And while he really wants her to win, that, you know, he really, they've had a little bit of a difficult time even scheduling him up until these last few weeks because he has so little time to give. But at the same time, you know, I think there's a strong sense that his legacy is very much bound up in her winning. It's not just personal. Of course, he wants his wife to win, and I think he thinks he'd have a great platform from the White House for the works that he's been doing. But also, he is a guy who just loves government and loves power. But also, you know, I think there is this sense that his legacy is unfinished and that her victory changes his historical standing. And I mentioned in the piece that I went and saw him a bunch of times just to speak, and when he spoke in New Hampshire, at one of his speeches there, he sort of blurted out a line, a little aside that I've not heard him say publicly before, where he said, you know, Teddy Roosevelt proposed a lot of things that fell flat on their face in his time, and it wasn't until Franklin Roosevelt came along and got elected that he was able to enact a lot of them. And it seemed to me very clear that he was drawing a comparison and effectively saying, you know, I didn't get done everything I want to get done. You know, we ran up against a lot of resistance, a lot of change, but the opportunity now is different, and, you know, Hillary can sort of follow it through. That's really the underlying argument of the campaign, but it's also, I think, the way he sees his own identity bound up in all of this.
It is kind of interesting, if Hillary were to win the White House, to have Bill Clinton in the wings, and in effect, there would have been two sort of political family dynasties in the White House, the Bush family and the Clintons.
Yeah, this is something a lot of voters talk about, too, they don't like. You know, there is a real resistance in America, deep-seated, to this kind of dynastic impulse, and you're right. I mean, we would be talking about, if Hillary Clinton were to win and then win re-election, both of which are, you know, extremely far off at this point, but let's just say, for the sake of argument, she were to get 8 years in the White House, you could have been born in, you know, I'm thinking about this offhand right now, but you could have been born in 1980 and go, what, straight up until 2016. So you could be, whatever that is, 26 years old and never have known a time in your life when there wasn't someone named Bush or Clinton in the executive, you know, either the presidency or vice presidency.
And there's more Bushes and Clintons left.
Right, there's plenty of Bushes left. I mean, that's pretty remarkable. Now, you know, are we, you know, some people see this as sort of a doomsday scenario where we're heading back toward monarchy or whatever it is. I think more than anything, it's indicative of two things going on in American culture. It's indicative of the money in politics, right? That, I mean, we're just in this moment where you need either fame or a tremendous amount of money to be successful in national office, it seems. And so you have a huge advantage if your name is well known. And then the other piece of it is we just have the celebritization of the culture. I mean, we have television and the internet and everything has created, you know, over the last, you know, 20 years or so, we've really become a culture, a cult of personality in everything in the country. We want to know more and more about people. And so, you know, naturally when someone gets famous and politically successful, their whole family becomes of interest, and it opens up political opportunities for people who might not otherwise have had them.
I just saw another unflattering picture of Chelsea Clinton on the internet. I thought, oh no, poor Chelsea, she's back again.
Yeah, I mean, I you know, that is an interesting, that to me is, that has absolutely no political value, and I've never, you know, even, I've never even approached Chelsea as a line of questioning, and I've never met her, and I think she is entitled to her privacy. But I do, just as an American, as someone who cares about politics, I do find that an intriguing piece of this to me. What must it be like to have spent your formative childhood, teen years in the White House, to have gone out and gone to college and built a career, and to know that this could be all starting again? You know, I mean, I don't know if you, I don't know Chelsea at all, and I have no idea whether the answer to that question is, I can't wait to get back in the White House, it was so much fun, or whether the answer to that question is, I can't believe I have to do this again. But yeah, I really do think that's one of the great untold stories, and maybe something we'll never know, is what is it like for her? She is really in the middle of something now that no child in American history has ever really been subject to.
Maybe we'll get a book someday.
I wouldn't hold your breath.
Okay, let's go back to the phones. Here's Marty in Douglas County. Hi, Marty, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning. Bill Clinton was certainly not the first president to have had extramarital sex while in office. He was merely the first one to be impeached for it. Men in power, whether they're in Congress, corporations, universities, or whatever, have always taken sexual advantage of that power. Bill Clinton didn't invent that practice. All the men out there who are just so, oh my gosh, this happened, are so amazed that women aren't standing up and saying, oh my gosh, this happened. Well, we're all standing around going, so what else is new? So that's one statement. My feelings about the Clinton presidency are really quite conflicted. But I do feel intensely disappointed in the Democrats who didn't stand up against the more despicable actions of his presidency, and I think they didn't stand up was because the reason they didn't stand up was because the economy was on fire, and everybody was making so much money, which is, let's face it, one of the other more corrupting elements along with sex in our society.
So, Marty, are you influenced in your thoughts about Hillary Clinton based on what you thought about Clintonism or Bill Clinton?
No, I'm looking at her as a completely separate element, as I am. Well, right. I just think any of those Democratic candidates I would back any single one of them. I think they're all really terrific and have great strengths.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Matt, bye.
I think there's I think Marty is well within the mainstream where a lot of Democrats feel. You know, the only thing I would say is I think in the sort of zealous protection of Clinton against sort of the personal attacks from Republicans, there's been a little bit of a glossing over here. I don't think anyone doubted that Bill Clinton was capable of having extramarital affairs when he was elected president, and I don't think if he'd simply had an extramarital affair there would have either been impeachment proceedings or that we would still be talking about it to any extent 8 years later. I think it's fair to put this in a slightly different category. I mean, I don't want to go back to the Lewinsky affair. I don't think it merited impeachment, and I don't think it's terribly relevant to this campaign. But I do think it's historically inaccurate to say Bill Clinton didn't invent extramarital sex. Why do we make such a big deal about it? His circumstances were different, and I think legitimately, morally more troubling to people in a way that didn't make them, you know, necessarily Puritans or ignorant, but that, you know, that I think was I think it was reasonable to be more troubled by that than by a simple extramarital affair.
Okay, thank you for that call, Marty. And on to Ed in Wausau. Hi, Ed, go ahead.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for the program. One of the things of the Clintons, that sticks in my mind is Rwanda. That was just terrible, and Clinton could have done something, and he didn't. And one other minor one was under the Clinton reign where public radio essentially was becoming commercialized. But that's all that I have.
All right. Thanks for the call, Ed. And you mentioned Rwanda at the beginning of your call, and I know that later on Bill Clinton has said that that was one of the regrets of his presidency.
He has, yeah. I think if you asked him, I've not, at least not recently, but I think if you asked him, he would probably say that that is his greatest regret and has told many people that, Rwanda. And I think, you know, so he's not... I don't think anyone's glossed over that as a historical point. I think he has deep regrets about it, but it certainly sticks in the mind of a lot of liberals. As for the commercialization of public radio, I don't know much about that, but I do want to say that you can buy my book. And no, I'm just kidding. I don't hear that many commercials, so I don't know. I'm not sure what that's about.
All right. Well, thank you for that call, Ed. And I'm going to go now to Don in Evansville. Hi, Don. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. Great discussion today. I'm over the last 8 years, I think competency is becoming the most important issue. And at least during the Clinton years, there was the feeling that there was competency, although his middle-of-the-road policies, pro-business decisions and so forth are very disappointing to me. And if your guest is correct in that Hillary would just be continuing Clintonism, I'm really conflicted then, and I probably would support somebody like Obama or Edwards, but the main thing is getting somebody in who's competent and maybe having non-divided government for a change. That's all I have.
All right. Thanks a lot, Don.
You know, I think it was interesting to me what Don said. I'm trying to recall what he said early before he made that the last point. Anyway, it's slipping my mind. But, yeah, that's, I mean, this is the calculation that a lot of people have to make, right? Do they want, oh, he's talking about competence, I think was interesting. Mm-hmm. You know, this is the choice people have to make about whether they want to, you know, whether they want a continuation of Clintonism, whether they want to try something new. And the competence question, he's absolutely right about it, it has become a bigger issue, and it's a bigger issue on the Republican side. It's not just on the Clinton side. I mean, if you look at what Mitt Romney or Rudy Giuliani, John McCain have been saying sort of all along, I guess Huckabee somewhat lesser extent, you know, the argument has effectively been, this isn't a philosophical fight, this is about a presidency that hasn't been competent, that we can run things better, we can run a government better. And it'd be interesting if you had a Hillary Clinton nomination versus, let's say, a Mitt Romney nomination. You know, you would be, you know, you would have a campaign that was effectively all about who could run government better, I think.
Well, we have to leave it there, Matt Bai, but thanks so much for joining us this hour.
Anytime. I'm glad to do it, Veronica. Did a great job.
Thanks. It's been a lot of fun. Enjoyed your article. It's called The Clinton Referendum, and it ran in the New York Times Magazine. Matt Bai is also the author of the book, The Argument, Billionaires, Bloggers, and the Battle to Remake Democratic Politics. I'm Veronica Rickert, sitting in this hour for Kathleen Dunn, and I'd like to thank Carmen Jackson for producing this hour and Keisha Mabra for on-air production. Stay tuned. There's more talk coming up on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.